He was the rebel the world couldn't tame, the prophet they couldn't package, the man who sang not for charts, but for change. This is not the Bob Marley story. This is the other voice, the one they tried to silence. From the hills of Westmoreland to the halls of revolution, from bullets to prophecy, Peter Tosh never bowed. He burned. This is his truth. Uncut, unapologetic, undeniable. This is Peter Tosh, voice of the fire, the untold story. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Peter Tosh, A Journey Through Time, Episode 4. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 13, The Night of the Storm. September 11th, 1987. A date scorched into the flesh of reggae history. A night when the drums fell silent, when Babylon's rage took form, when the fire of a prophet was extinguished not with argument, not with censorship, but with gunfire. It was a Friday evening in Kingston. The heat sat thick on the city like a warning, the kind of stillness that feels less like peace and more like a breath being held. Somewhere in the hills above Halfway Tree, in a modest home nestled on Hope Road, a home filled with scriptures, books, guitars, and the scent of burnt herb, Peter Tosh sat with his close friends, laughing, reasoning, relaxing. He had just returned from a trip to the United States, where he'd been laying groundwork for his No Nuclear War album, the latest manifestation of his lifelong message. One love, one truth, but no compromise. It would turn out to be his final album, and he was proud of it, his voice still sharp, his mind still ablaze. Despite all he had endured, there was light in his eyes that night. He had reason to smile. After years of industry sabotage, police harassment, and spiritual exile, things seemed, if not perfect, then peaceful. But Peter was never the type of man to believe in peace without vigilance. He had been having dreams, dark ones. He told friends he felt something was coming, that the system wasn't done with him yet, that Babylon had a final card to play. But even the sharpest prophet can't see every dagger in the dark. As the sun dropped behind the Blue Mountains and the sky turned from molten gold to indigo, the evening settled. Peter was home, surrounded by people he trusted, journalist Michael Robinson, drummer Santa Davis, his partner Marlene Brown, and a few close friends. There was music in the air, the rhythm of soft reasoning, the sound of a man who had fought so long he could finally exhale. Then came the knock. No warning, just the knock. Three men entered. Familiar faces, one of them an acquaintance from Peter's past. Dennis Lepo Lobin, a man Peter had once helped, mentored, even clothed. A man who had walked with him at times when no one else would. A man who had been in and out of prison, and who Peter had tried to guide towards something better. That was Peter's way, always reaching out to the outcasts, the unwanted, the forgotten. But sometimes, mercy can be mistaken for weakness. And sometimes, the knife is handed to the one you feed. They entered asking for money. At first, it seemed like a desperate plea, one of many Peter had heard before. He was known to give freely to those in need. But something was off. Their eyes didn't match their words. Their hands trembled, not with desperation, but with intent. One of them pulled a gun, and in that moment, the storm began. Peter stood his ground. He wasn't a man who bowed, even to bullets. Reports say he tried to reason with them, spoke calmly, tried to defuse. But these weren't boys looking for wisdom. They weren't looking for cash. They had come for something else, and Peter knew it. They tied everyone up, made them lie on the floor. Pistol whipped Michael Robinson so brutally he would never recover. Beat the others into silence. All the while, Peter remained standing, still trying to understand. Why? Why now? Why this? Why him? Then came the sound. Cold. Final. Gunfire. One shot first. Then another. Then a storm of bullets. Peter was hit at close range, multiple times. Chest. Head. Stomach. Legs. The dreadlocked lion, the prophet, the rebel who had withstood batons and betrayal, censorship and exile, finally dropped to the floor of his own home. Shot by men he once tried to save. He died there. Not on a stage. Not in exile. But on the floor of his own house. Surrounded by books, guitars, smoke and blood. He died not in the arms of a cheering crowd, but under the silence of betrayal. And outside, the world carried on, unaware that its fiercest truth-teller had just been silenced. The killers fled. Some say they were amateurs. Others believe it was more than a robbery, too clean, too targeted, too convenient. A man who had spent decades exposing governments, warning of CIA infiltration, speaking about international sabotage. Now gunned down on the exact date, September 11th, that had marked other dark chapters in Jamaican history. Coincidence? Peter didn't believe in coincidences, and neither do many of us. The official story pointed to Lepo and his two accomplices as the culprits. Lepo was captured, tried, convicted, sentenced to death, later commuted to life. But the story never sat right. There were whispers that someone had used Lepo, that higher hands had orchestrated the moment, that Babylon had finally found a way to finish the job without leaving fingerprints. Whatever the truth, one fact remains. Peter Tosh was silenced by a bullet, but the bullet never touched his message. Jamaica mourned. The reggae world trembled, but the grief was complicated. For years, Peter had been erased from mainstream recognition. Now, his death forced the world to remember him. Crowds gathered at his memorial service. Some wept, some sang, some stared silently, still unsure how such a towering voice could be taken so cheaply. The system did not apologize. The press ran headlines, but not retrospectives. No national day of mourning. No statues. No grand tributes. Not then. Only whispers. Only silence. Only absence. But the silence didn't last. Because in the hills, in the ghettos, in the streets of Kingston, Lagos, Accra, Johannesburg, Amsterdam, and Brooklyn, his voice began to rise again. Played on bootleg tapes. Painted on walls. Chanted in marches. Quoted in speeches. Studied by youth who knew that Peter hadn't just made music. He had made truth. And truth doesn't die in the dark. It waits. It breathes. It rises. Peter Tosh's death wasn't just a tragedy. It was a sacrifice. A message written in blood. A reminder that truth tellers don't retire, they are taken. And even in death, Peter became more powerful. More untouchable. More eternal. He had walked the earth like a lion. He had roared when others whispered. He had lived with conviction and died with dignity. Not every prophet gets a temple. Some just get remembered. One bullet at a time. Chapter 14, Who Killed Peter Tosh. The smoke had cleared. The blood had dried. The candles had melted down to nothing. But the questions remained. Long after Peter Tosh's body was laid to rest, long after the funeral ended and the headlines faded, a single question echoed like thunder across Jamaica and the world. Who killed Peter Tosh? Not just who pulled the trigger, but who planned it, who benefited from it, who sat comfortably while the only uncompromising voice in reggae was silenced with the finality of gunfire, who wanted Peter Tosh gone badly enough to make it look like a robbery, but feel like an execution. For many, the official story has never been enough. Three men entered Peter's home on the night of September 11th, 1987. They held his friends at gunpoint. They beat and pistol-whipped those who resisted. They demanded money. And when Peter offered none, when he as always stood firm, they shot him point blank. That's what the police said. That's what the newspapers printed. But those who knew Peter, those who had followed his fire, his warnings, his defiance, they knew better. They knew Peter had made powerful enemies. Because Peter didn't just sing about injustice, he named names. He called out government leaders, accused police of torture, claimed international intelligence agencies were infiltrating Jamaica. He warned about the CIA's role in destabilizing reggae artists. He spoke openly of files, dossiers, threats. He refused to be quiet, and for that, many believe he was targeted. The official story, a robbery gone wrong? The Jamaican police investigation concluded that Peter Tosh was murdered during a botched home invasion. The primary assailant was identified as Dennis Lepo Lobin, a man Tosh had once helped reintegrate into society after serving prison time. Peter had offered him food, clothes, money. Some even said he saw Lepo like a lost brother, damaged but redeemable. Lepo repaid that trust with bullets. According to the prosecution, Lepo and his accomplices, two other men, entered Tosh's residence to demand money. When Peter refused, they became violent. A physical confrontation broke out. Then the shooting started. Tosh was killed. Several others were wounded, including music journalist Michael Robinson and drummer Santa Davis. Lepo was caught, tried, convicted, sentenced to death. Later, his sentence was commuted to life in prison. Case closed, at least on paper. But for many, including Peter's fans, family, and even several government insiders, the official story was too neat. too convenient, too shallow. Because the real question wasn't if Leppo shot Peter Tosh. The question was why, and who told him to. The loose threads, what didn't add up? Almost immediately after the murder, inconsistencies began to surface. Witnesses claimed the attackers weren't merely robbers, they were calm, organized, unflinching. They moved with military efficiency. They knew exactly where to go. They didn't ransack the house looking for valuables. They didn't take much at all. The supposed motive never matched the method. Some said it looked less like a robbery, and more like a hit. And then there was Leppo himself. A petty criminal, yes, but not known as a killer. Not known for leadership. Not known for having the kind of tactical planning the attack required. Who gave him the guns? Who planned the timing? Why choose a night when Peter had just returned from international travel and was surrounded by close friends? Peter's home wasn't a party house. It wasn't easily accessed. It wasn't random. Someone had studied him. Someone had waited. And when they struck, they didn't just try to intimidate him. They made sure he died. 6 bullets. Chest. Stomach. Head. Not a warning. An execution. Theory number 1, the Jamaican government. Peter Tosh had spent years publicly accusing the Jamaican government of corruption, brutality, and complicity in violence against Rastas. He named both major parties, PNP and JLP, as agents of Babylon. He accused leaders like Michael Manley and Edward Sega of making backdoor deals with foreign powers, of allowing police brutality to flourish, and of selling out Jamaican sovereignty for IMF loans and international approval. In 1978, during the One Love Peace concert, Peter had stood on stage before both men and in a 10-minute, off-script tirade, accused them of abandoning the people. He lit a spliff on stage and told the Prime Minister to his face, "You not no different from Sega. All of you is hypocrites. No one else had ever done that. Not Marley. Not any journalist. Not any union leader. Only Peter." And after that moment, many believe, he was marked. Not for imprisonment. Not for exile. But for removal. Whether the government pulled the trigger themselves, or simply looked the other way, is still debated. But what's certain is that Peter's voice had become too loud, too fearless, too consistent for those who wanted a peaceful lie to keep selling. And when he refused to stop, they let the bullets speak. Theory number 2, foreign intelligence, CIA MI6. Peter wasn't just a Jamaican problem. He had international reach and international enemies. He had accused the CIA of monitoring him. He believed that his phone was tapped, that his tours were infiltrated, that certain concerts were canceled not for security reasons, but because governments feared the consciousness he was spreading. He spoke out against apartheid in South Africa, long before it became trendy. He called out Ronald Reagan by name, mocking his nuclear policies and foreign wars. His final album, No Nuclear War, was banned from certain US radio stations. And in several interviews, Peter warned, "They don't want me alive. They want a Marley they can control. Me, them half he kill." Was it paranoia? Or was it prophecy? Declassified US documents in later years confirmed that many reggae artists, especially those with militant messages, had been monitored. Bob Marley had been watched. So had Peter. In an age of Cold War paranoia, anything that could inspire revolution in black communities was treated as a threat. Peter's music wasn't just catchy. It was activism set to bass. To the wrong ears, that made him a national security threat. To others, a target. Theory number 3, the music industry. Peter's feud with the music industry was legendary. He refused to be commercialized. Refused to smile for executives. Refused to dress up for marketing photos. He accused Island Records, CBS, and Rolling Stone magazine of promoting Marley while silencing him. He challenged contracts. Spoke openly about exploitation. Mocked executives on camera. He called the music industry a plantation with fancier chains. And they hated him for it. Was Peter becoming a liability? Was someone afraid of what he'd reveal? Of what he already knew? Or perhaps the bigger fear was that he couldn't be bought. Because in a world where everything has a price, the man who can't be owned becomes the most dangerous man of all. The silence that followed. After Peter's murder, something strange happened. Nothing. No government investigation beyond the basic arrest. No documentaries aired. No mainstream tributes. No international outrage. Not even his music was widely replayed. Just a void. A vacuum. As if someone wanted the world to forget. But the world didn't forget. In the hills, his name still echoed. In Africa, his songs still march through movements. In Europe, his face was spray-painted on revolution walls. In the Caribbean, in underground sound systems, in prison cells and university dorms, Peter's voice refused to die. Because people knew what the headlines wouldn't say. Peter Tosh wasn't just murdered. He was assassinated. Silenced. For truth. For daring to live free in a world that profits off chains. Chapter 15, The Spirit Lives On. Peter Tosh died on the floor of his own home, bloody, betrayed, brutalized. But prophets don't stay buried. Their words become winds. Their message becomes a rhythm that outlives sirens, censorship, and silence. And Peter, more than most, became the echo. It didn't happen overnight. His death in 1987 passed like a ghost through the mainstream. No candlelight vigils on television. No United Nations tribute. No Grammys honoring a fallen pioneer. Just the sound of doors shutting, of Babylon exhaling in relief. One of its fiercest critics had been silenced. Or so they thought. Because the truth, real truth, has a way of resurrecting itself in the very spaces it was banished from. And Peter Tosh? He was reborn in those spaces. In the ghettos. In the university classrooms. In African villages and Parisian alleyways. In freedom marches and prison yards. In headphones of revolutionaries and notebooks of poets. He was reborn not as a commercial icon, but as something bigger, a symbol, a system, a sacred idea. The music refused to die. For years after his death, Peter's music remained underplayed, underpromoted, and underrepresented by the very institutions that celebrated his peers. But on the streets, in the grassroots, his sound refused to fade. Bootleg tapes circulated from hand to hand. Old vinyls played at late-night Rasta gatherings. Songs like Equal Rights, Legalize It, Stepping Razor, and Mystic Man became anthems for movements that had no official flag, no central leader, only fire. In South Africa, where apartheid still gripped the nation in the late 80s, his music was illegal. And yet, Equal Rights could be heard in underground clubs, whispered on rebel radio, chanted at protests. Young revolutionaries saw Peter not as a distant Jamaican artist, but as one of their own. His rage mirrored theirs. His vision prophetic. In the United States, black youth facing police brutality and systemic racism adopted his words like scripture. Peter's lyrics didn't talk about survival, they demanded dignity. He didn't ask for a seat at the table. He demanded to burn the table down and build a new one. His voice became a tool, not just for music, but for mobilization. The rise of the Peter Tosh Foundation. In the years following his death, his family, led by his son, Jawara McIntosh, also known as Tosh One, fought tirelessly to reclaim Peter's legacy, not just as a reggae icon, but as a human rights warrior. They established the Peter Tosh Foundation, a nonprofit committed to defending civil rights, promoting cannabis legalization, protecting Rasta culture, and providing education to underserved communities. They didn't ask for handouts. They built schools, created scholarship funds, organized events celebrating the messages Peter had lived and died for. And perhaps most significantly, they spoke Peter's name when the world tried to erase it. Jawara, himself a gifted musician, continued his father's mission until he too became a target. Arrested in the United States for cannabis possession, he was beaten into a coma while in custody, eventually passing away in 2020. Another Tosh. Another life taken by the very system his father warned about. Another prophet silenced. But the fire didn't die. It multiplied. The Peter Tosh Museum, a shrine of resistance. In 2016, nearly three decades after his death, the Peter Tosh Museum opened in Kingston, Jamaica. Not in a shiny corporate arena, but in the Pulse Center, a cultural complex dedicated to Caribbean art and resistance. The museum isn't a tourist trap. It's a sanctuary. Inside, visitors walk past his guitars, his handwritten lyrics, his bullet-riddled memorabilia. His voice plays overhead, still warning, still teaching, still witnessing. You see the man's eyes staring back at you, not with fame, but with fire. You see his cane shaped like an M16, his books on African liberation, his altar to Haile Selassie. It's more than a display. It's testimony. A place where truth is curated not for comfort, but for confrontation. A cultural resurrection. Over time, the world could no longer ignore Peter. Not after the rise of global cannabis legalization. Not after Ferguson or Flint or Gaza or the Sudan uprisings or the chants of no justice, no peace in every hemisphere. Peter's message, once dismissed as militant or angry, suddenly became necessary. His words aged like prophecy. His interviews, once controversial, now played like documentaries. His warnings about police, governments, religion, and industry became eerily relevant. Modern artists began sampling his voice. Academics began writing books about his philosophy, not just his music, but his ideological framework. Peter Tosh was no longer a footnote in reggae. He was being redefined as one of the great liberation thinkers of the 20th century, alongside Fanon, Garvey, and Malcolm X. College courses emerged focused on his lyrics. Documentaries and podcasts examined his theories. Murals rose in Toronto, Nairobi, and Rio de Janeiro. Even the United Nations, once silent during his life, began quoting his lyrics in human rights conferences. Equal rights became more than a song. It became a slogan on banners, in protests from Venezuela to Hong Kong. He had been reborn, not by corporations, but by consciousness, his spirit in activism. Peter's calls for cannabis legalization weren't rooted in Western recreational culture. For him, ganja was a sacrament, a weapon against mental slavery. And as the global cannabis conversation shifted from criminal to medicinal to legal, Peter's voice was recognized as one of the earliest, most righteous calls for reform. Even in Jamaica, where ganja once brought police raids and imprisonment, Peter's words now line the walls of dispensaries, clinics, and wellness centers. He is quoted in legal papers. His interviews are cited in pro-legalization laws across the Caribbean. But Peter's vision was always bigger than cannabis. He wanted reparations. He wanted African unity. He wanted spiritual freedom. And his spirit now flows through activists and thinkers who carry that mission into the 21st century. Black Lives Matter, Pan-African Congresses, ganja reform, reparations demands, youth protest movements, Rasta education initiatives. He's everywhere, though his name isn't always said. Because that's how spirit works. It doesn't need credit. It moves. The legacy he never asked for. Peter never wanted monuments. He wanted justice. He didn't want to be immortalized in bronze. He wanted Babylon dismantled. But legacy is a strange thing. You can't always choose how it grows. You can only plant the seeds with truth and hope the soil doesn't choke them. Peter Tosh planted those seeds in fire and rain. And now, decades later, the trees are rising. Young people, some not even born when he died, now chant his name. Activists print his quotes. Artists remix his vocals. Political prisoners whisper his lyrics in solitary. Farmers in the hills bless the ganja crop in his name. He has become timeless. Not because the world finally accepted him, but because the world finally caught up. Chapter 16, If He Could Speak Now. If Peter Tosh could speak now, it would not be in past tense. It would not be in silence or nostalgia. It would be in thunder, in vibration, in the language of drums rising from soil soaked in blood. It would be in patois and prophecy, rhythm and roar. It would not be a voice asking permission. It would be a voice taking its place, taking back the mic from the liars, the system, the same world that killed him, and dared to keep selling his smile without his scars. It would sound like wind in the hills of Westmoreland. It would smell like burning herb in the bush, like sweat after struggle, like iron and rain and redemption. It would look you dead in the eye and say, "You miss me now, but where were you when me still die?" You chant me name in protest now. You paint me face on mural walls. You call me prophet, ancestor, legend. But when I was bleeding, when me voice was banned, when police mash me bones like iron under Babylon boots, where were you? You say justice for Tosh now. But justice is not retroactive. Justice is active. Justice is now. So if me spirit walk again in this world, me not come for flowers. Me come fight truth. You still waiting for peace. But me tell you, peace without justice is illusion. I didn't die for peace. Peace is a bed you lie on when the truth too sharp for your skin. I didn't die for unity. Unity without dignity is slavery in disguise. I died because I refused to beg. I died because I refused to sell out. Because I looked at the leaders in jacket and tie and told them they were wolves in sermon suits. I died because I called the Pope a liar and the priest a puppet. I died because I told black people they were gods, not beggars. So if you really listen to me now, listen with action, not applause. Stop making me a myth. Me not no fairy tale. Me was fire. They want to make me soft now. Make me gentle like lullaby. Play legalize it in whitewash lounges and smile like revolution was a joke. But me didn't just sing about ganja. Me bled for Rasta. Me died for blackness. Me stood on Babylon's steps and spat in their lies, and they made sure I would not stand again. Don't make me a Marley poster with no teeth. Me not smile for them. Me never did. Me face is not for comfort. Me face is for warning. Remember that. Me message still relevant because you still in chains. Chains look different now, yes. Dem shiny. Digital. Wrapped in likes and filters. Wrapped in student loans, paywalls, church pews with colonial sermons. You think you free because you can scroll? You think you free because you can vote? Ask yourself, who you voting for? Who owns the food? The land? The air? Who decide what truth is? You still in Babylon. It just wear different clothes now. And if me voice could reach you again, it would say, burn it down with wisdom. Build it back with roots. Don't wait for another Peter Tosh. Be your own. Me not coming back in flesh. Me done. Me gone home to Zion, walking barefoot in vibration, reasoning with Haile Selassie, with Garvey, with Malcolm, with Fela, with Jawarami Sun, who now chant alongside me in the higher realm. But you still here. Still in Babylon. Still in Babylon schools. Babylon banks. Babylon thoughts. And so me ask you, will you just play me music? Or will you live it? Will you chant down Babylon with your playlists? Or with your life? You want revolution? Then become it. Don't wait for another album to save you. Don't wait for politicians to hear you. Don't wait for Sunday to start being spiritual. Every breath is prayer. Every step is protest. Every dollar is a vote. Every silence is a side. So choose. Choose to be awake. Choose to be dangerous. Choose to be true. Me done sing me verse. Now you write yours. Me was never just a man. Me was mission. And missions don't die. They transform. Me lyrics now live in your bloodstream. Me fire now breathe in your lungs. Me dreadlocks now grow in your courage. So don't mourn me like tombstone. Mourn me by rising. Rise with your fist. Rise with your heart. Rise with your mind clean. Me didn't die so you could remember me. Me died so you could become me. So become more. More rebel. More mystic. More man. More woman. More light. More fire. Peter Tosh is not gone. He is waiting inside you. The question is, will you let him speak?